Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Somalia's Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble and President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed have a long-standing dispute over the long-delayed elections. Now, there are constant fears that their squabbling could erupt into violence amid a split in the country's security forces. Now, the following remarks by Prime Minister Roble are indicative of divided loyalties within the country's security forces. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on Somalia's protracted political crisis that is threatening to derail efforts to restore stability in this war-torn Horn of Africa nation. We are asking, are foreign powers with vested interest fomenting the political crisis in Somalia? Now, the second part of our show will be about revelations that Belgium was involved in the assassination of Burundi independence hero and Prime Minister Louis Rwagasore 60 years ago. Stay tuned with us until the end of the show as our experts give us their analysis.
Somalia's protracted crisis. Somalia descended into a civil war over 30 years ago following the collapse of the government of President Siad Barre in January 1991. Global effects led to the formation of a federal government in Somalia, which made some progress in rebuilding the country. Al-Shabaab terrorists have also been pushed out of most major towns. However, this little progress made is in jeopardy following intense rivalry between the Somali president and prime minister. The rivalry has also led to a split in the country's security forces. These tensions are believed to have ignited by a political dispute over delayed elections. A vote had been due in February 2021, but it stalled following disagreements on the electoral process. Many Somalis have expressed disappointment over the dispute between the president and prime minister.
Now, the warring parties have now agreed to have the elections on the 25th of February this year. A new head of Somalia's federal election implementation team has been appointed to speed up the whole process. Now, he speaks here after his appointment recently.
As regards the long-delayed election and the new election deadline, which is a big burden on us, we are committed to start quickly and meet this new deadline.
Now, to analyze the current situation in Somalia, we have contacted Sheikh Abdi Hersi, a Somali Muslim scholar and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
My pleasure.
Now, can you first tell us what is the source of this intense rivalry between the Somali president and prime minister?
The source of this problem is two things. First is corruption. The prime minister looks and is corrupted. He's looking for a way to increase his own personal means. And because of that, he will be vulnerable to be used by the second source of the problem, which is interference from outside. And that is how it started. The prime minister went outside to meet foreign presidents and foreign leaders, and after he came back, the problem started.
The Horn of Africa continues to witness international interference that is causing extreme destabilization in the region, from Djibouti and Eritrea to Somalia and Ethiopia. Western imperialists continue to support dictators and block any attempt at true independence, while some Western-backed Persian Gulf states are transforming the region into a battlefield against each other. Which foreign powers are involved in escalating the tensions in Somalia, and what are their interests?
And Emirates is heavily involved, and there are also European Union, and also the ambassador of the United Kingdom, Kate Foster, is heavily involved. And right now we see U.S. is also engaging into interference of the political independence of Somalia, dictating what to happen and what not to happen.
Following international pressure, Somali leaders announced they struck a deal to complete parliamentary elections by the 25th of February. Now, the agreement was reached after talks hosted by Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble with state leaders aimed at ending the deadlock over the polls.
Lower House elections will be completed by February 25th, 2022.
Now, Sheikh Hersi, will these polls really solve the country's political crisis, and what is the likely outcome of the elections?
I believe so. Elections will be the only solution for the rivalry that we have right now in the political system in Somalia. One is a government is put in power and mandate is given to a new president, whether it is the current president or a new person. That person will be given a mandate of 4 years. They will have a fresh start. There will always be opposition and people that don't want that person to succeed from the get-go. However, it will solve the majority of the problem. Election will be held, president will be elected, the problem will be, I believe, solved.
As the rivalry between political factions in Somalia escalates, we have seen an upsurge in terrorist attacks by Al-Shabaab. This Al-Qaeda-linked group is seeking to overthrow the government in Mogadishu and controls some area of southern Somalia from where it regularly launches attacks in the capital and elsewhere. A Somali citizen speaks here after an attack by terrorists. Is the Al-Shabaab terrorist group taking advantage of the dispute within the federal government to launch more attacks?
The majority of the Somali people, including myself, believe that Al-Shabaab is a foreign agent. It's something that's used to destabilize Somalia. All these opposing interests from outside or foreign actors are using in a way or another that Al-Shabaab is sustained. It continues to fight. And every time there is a political gridlock in the political system of the Somali government, this entity and its likes will have a chance to take advantage on the differences.
Late December, the UN Security Council adopted the resolution reauthorizing the African Union mission in Somalia to continue its presence in the country until the 31st of March 2022. This comes ahead of a phased handover of responsibilities to Somalia's security forces. What happens after that? Is Somalia ready to take care of its own security?
Yes, Somalia is ready to take charge of its security, and they want AMISOM out. Also, they want Operation Atlanta, which is patrolling the maritime of Somalia, out. They also want they regained the control of their air. Somalia is gaining its sovereignty piece by piece.
The United States has deployed special forces in the Horn of Africa region to ostensibly combat Al-Shabaab terrorists. Yet, this Takfiri group remains active. Mr. Hersi, what are the American forces really doing in Somalia since this Takfiri terrorist group remains active in the country?
To be honest, America is not doing what they tell the world they are doing anywhere in the world. I don't believe a bit of what they say about combating Al-Shabaab. They don't fight with Al-Shabaab. And sometimes they don't allow the troops that they train to fight with Al-Shabaab. They are there for other interests. It's just like everywhere in Horn of Africa, America is being perceived as a political interfering actor. They are here to advance their own interests. They're not here to combat the terror group Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab, maximum manpower they have is less than, when you exaggerate, they say 4,000, 3,000, 5,000 people. They don't have heavy artillery or heavy weapons. They have only AK-47 or something like that, small personal army.
Now, Mr. Hersi, you have said that the Americans are not in Somalia to fight the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Now, what are they pursuing in this country?
If all these powers, including U.S., are honest about combating Al-Shabaab, Al-Shabaab would be gone long, long time ago. So they could be there for taking or stealing Somali minerals, including uranium. That's what they've been accused. They could be there for other interests and to spy in Horn of Africa, to interfere political affairs of the neighboring countries or Horn of Africa like Ethiopia and Eritrea. America is being perceived as the other. They're not perceived as an ally. They are perceived by the people. They're perceived as enemy. If they go and leave, that would be the biggest day that people will celebrate every corner of Horn of Africa.
Well, there you have it. The United States is perceived as an enemy of the people in the Horn of Africa region. Thanks a lot, Sheikh Abdi Hersi, for your insights. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about Belgium's reported involvement in the assassination of Burundi independence hero Louis Rwagasore. Stay with us.
Belgium implicated in murder of Burundian Prime Minister.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
An investigation has revealed that a popular Burundi prime minister, Prince Louis Rwagasore, was shot dead in 1961. And now, Belgium, the departing colonial power, is being accused of complicity in the assassination. Rwagasore remains one of Burundi's most beloved heroes, with his name gracing stadiums, schools, and roads across the country.
Ludo de Witte, a Belgian writer and political activist, conducted the investigation and concluded that the Belgian state has an overwhelming responsibility for the assassination of Rwagasore. De Witte spent 5 years investigating the killing. He is also internationally known for his investigation on the assassination of Congo's first elected prime minister, Patrice Lumumba.
Every year, on the 13th of October, Burundi always commemorates the assassination of Prince Louis Rwagasore. A member of the family of the assassinated independence hero speaks here during one such event.
In my family, we know him as a peaceful man. He wanted peace for everybody, all Burundians. There was assassination, there was sponsors. So today, we need that truth will be out and that sponsors would ask for forgiveness.
Now, for more on this crime against the people of Burundi, we contacted Claude Gachebuke, Executive Director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot, Mr. Gachebuke, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, can you tell us more about this report which has been published to the effect that Belgium was involved in the assassination of Prince Rwagasore?
The truth is at the root of ending impunity and bringing justice to the perpetrators in the region, not just in Burundi, but in the whole region of the Great Lakes of Africa. It's an area that is mired in impunity, and the lasting impunity continues to produce more cycles of violence after cycles of violence. And zeroing in on the responsible is an important event. And the fact that the Belgians had a hand in the killing and a responsibility, a major responsibility, according to this new book by Mr. De Witt, a Belgian national, who's investigated this and written about it, written a book about it. It talks about how the Belgian resident governor convened a crisis meeting and stated, in quotes, Guagasore must be killed.
Rwagasore is said to have aspired for unity of Burundi's different ethnic groups, the Hutus, Tutsi, and Gangwas. He also wanted true independence from Belgium and not just superficial independence that would be followed by neo-colonialism. Considering the stances taken by Rwagasore, what would have been the objective of Belgium in his assassination?
I think the objective and the goal of the Belgians in the murder of Prince Rwagasore is the same as the objective of killing Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. It's been shown that the Belgians and the CIA were also involved in the killing of Patrice Lumumba. These are two popular leaders in the region, both who whose politics were about uniting the people instead of perpetuating the ethnic differences. And colonialism introduced a next level of discrimination in the region. So getting rid of Prince Rwagasore, who was a popularly elected leader, who also surprised them when he was elected because they expected somebody else to win, they realized that they couldn't control him, so they also realized they couldn't control Patrice Lumumba, and both of these leaders ended up getting killed because the Belgians could not control them. They were losing.
Ethnic violence and intense political rivalry dominated Burundi after its independence, and many accused Belgium of sowing the seeds of discord to ensure its former colony never attains unity for prosperity. It's only during the past decade that the country has witnessed relative peace. How did the assassination of Rwagasore affect the future of Burundi, a country that witnessed upheavals and ethnic conflict for decades?
It's been bloody. I think his assassination, considering his politics, really set Burundi years back in terms of setting it on a path of violence instead of a path of unity and a path of, you know, where they would thrive and excel and do well as a nation. So it crippled the Burundian nation because it removed a person who was not an ethnic supremacist, somebody who was a not driven by violence, and installed violent ethnic supremacists who conducted ethnic cleansing campaigns and even genocide.
In 2018, Burundi accused former colonial power Belgium of ordering the assassination of independence hero Rwagasore. A government statement said Belgium was the true backer of the assassination of Rwagasore. Now, this was the first direct accusation over the murder by the Burundi government, which at that time said it plans to probe the six-decade-old incident. Speaking at an event in early January, Burundi's President Evariste Ndayishimiye said the country wishes to see the truth coming out to light regarding past crimes in this country. Let's take a listen.
Nuko kuri kose ibyabaye byose umwaka wari wo wose byoza habona kugira ngo bitubere ikigwa ni haba ukuri turondera arukuza kuduca mwimice uko kuri ntacho koba kumaze twofuma tukureka.
Mr. Gachabuke, is the government of Burundi taking any action to follow up on the assassination of Rwagasore?
I haven't seen anything yet, but I'm hoping that they do something because, again, I think that in order for the Great Lakes region of Africa to have lasting peace and for the continent of Africa to have lasting peace and to prosper, there must be justice. In order for there to be justice, there must be truth. So with this truth being revealed, then the next step is justice. And that justice may be in the form of reparations or other things. But at this point, I just haven't seen anything major, you know, coming of it yet.
Rwagasore, sometimes called Burundi's Lumumba, has been one of the few political figures in modern Burundian history to be remembered fondly across the ethnic and social lines. One of Rwagasore's contemporaries speaks here on his legacy.
It's about time our leaders, youth, revisited and listened well to the speech of Rwagasore, inspired themselves from his ideology to get back the national unity.
Last October, several celebration events were held across the country in memory of Rwagasore. What is the status of Rwagasore amongst the people of Burundi?
Prince Rwagasore is somebody that's considered a very important historical figure, one of the national heroes of Burundi, because, again, as I said, he is considered a, you know, the independent, you know, the person that was at the forefront of the independence movement. But when you look at Prince Rwagasore, he seems to be the one of the very few people that Burundians that I talk to and Burundians that I've come across, and, you know, even looking at how he's treated in the history of Burundi, as one of those who seem to be a transcending figure. A transcending figure in terms of ethnicity, a transcending figure in terms of politics, because everyone sees him as somebody that was really important and fair in the past of Burundi, who did not get a chance to actually show what he can really do for Burundians and for the country of Burundi.
Now, according to estimates, at least 10 million African people were killed during Belgium's colonial rule over what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. Similar acts of genocide were committed by Belgian colonial forces in Rwanda and Burundi. Now, isn't it about time that the Belgian government apologizes and pays reparations for its crimes against Africans during the colonial period?
Absolutely. It is time that, you know, Belgium apologizes to its former colonies. Not only apologize, but also pay reparations. And I look at Burundi and Rwanda, they had it bad in terms of forced labor. You know, people were being beaten, you know, to work. It was hard labor. There were so many things, you know, and so many violations, so many human rights violations during colonialism in Rwanda and Burundi. And worse crimes were committed in the Congo. The Congo, people's hands were chopped off for refusing to perform labor or for not performing to the level that the Belgians expected. The Congolese people, millions of Congolese people, were killed under Leopold, King Leopold of Belgium, who treated Congo as his own personal property. And there was so much resources that were plundered out of the Congo. So many resources plundered out of the region, but especially in the Congo.
Well, thank you, Claude Gachebuke, for your insight. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, coordination of factors and elements of training or raising children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of coordination of factors and elements of raising or training children in the Islamic lifestyle. It is very important to have a coordination or match of all factors that are basically that are involved in training kids, that are involved in training the children or raising the children. And one of the factors is that our children, when they reach to a specific age, for example, when they are at the teen age, at that time, parents have passed this age. Obviously, they are in the mid-age, and the parents are more patient as compared to children. Whereas these children have enthusiasm, they have more energy as compared to the parents. And therefore, we need to take care of this energy which they have. Obviously, it is because they're young, they're at the teen age, they're at the age where they want to experience many things. And on top of that, we being the parents, because we are very calm, we have reached to a stage where we are calm, we have controlled our energy, we need to train them in a way so that they can also become able of controlling their energy, extra energy, and do not waste the energy that they have. Or maybe they should put that energy in a way which is beneficial for them, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the coordination of factors and elements of raising children or training children. We said that we need to have a coordination between different factors, and one of the issues that we see generally in training kids or raising kids, according to the Islamic teachings, it is said that because the parents are at the age where they're calm now, they can control their energies, but the children, because they're at the, for example, they're at the teenage or before that or maybe after that, and they have a lot of energy, they should learn how to control their extra energy. Or the children should be raised in a way so they should be able to use their energy in the right way, not in the falsehood. So therefore, it is the duty of the parents that when they are training the kids, when they are raising kids, they should teach them the right way, the right place of using the energy, basically. And if we can match these things, then obviously we can see that our kids, the way we have planned for them, or the way we followed a plan, according to that plan, we could have trained or raised kids in the best way, in the best manner. And that's what Islam basically emphasizes on. It says that you need to provide what they want, but obviously through the halal means. And they should spend their energy in a halal way, so they should learn it. If they have learned it, they can do it. If they haven't learned it, then obviously they can go and waste the energy that they have, maybe outside, maybe in the school, maybe anywhere where they are. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The increasing popularity of cryptocurrency has environmentalists on edge, as the digital mining of it creates a massive carbon footprint due to the staggering amount of energy it requires. We now present you an article written by Robin Scher, a writer based in South Africa and a graduate of the Cultural Reporting and Criticism Program at New York University. The piece is titled, "As Crypto Goes Mainstream, Its Carbon Footprint Can't Be Ignored." For advocates of cryptocurrency, the promise of an economic future that is managed by a blockchain, a decentralized database that is shared among the nodes of a computer network as opposed to being held in a single location, such as a central bank, is compelling. For anyone paying attention, the rapid expansion of cryptocurrency has been stunning. In 2019, the global cryptocurrency market was approximately $793 million. According to a report by the market research organization Facts and Factors, it's now expected to reach nearly $5.2 billion by 2026. In just 1 year, between July of 2020 and June of 2021, the global adoption of cryptocurrency surged by more than 880%. But the increasing popularity of cryptocurrency has environmentalists on edge, as the digital mining of it creates a massive carbon footprint due to the staggering amount of energy that it requires. According to a February 2021 CNBC article based on data from the Bitcoin Energy Consumption Index from DigiEconomist, an online tool created by data scientist Alex DeVries, the carbon footprint of Bitcoin, the world's largest cryptocurrency, is equivalent to that of New Zealand, with both emitting nearly 37 megatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. To understand why this is a problem, it's important to explain what goes into creating a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. Unlike fiat money, which is regulated through central banks, transactions in Bitcoin are tracked through a public ledger consisting of a network of computers around the world, the blockchain. Mining, a process in which computational puzzles are solved in order to verify transactions between users, which are then added to the blockchain, allows this validation to take place, which is an energy-intensive process. It has been a bit of a wild ride for Bitcoin. The market price of a single Bitcoin plunged below $30,000 in June of 2021 for the first time since January of 2021, falling by more than half from its April peak of around $65,000. Nevertheless, some analysts and billionaire investors are still feeling bullish about the crypto coin, as several leading businesses continue to adopt the currency. Goldman Sachs started trading Bitcoin futures Agreeing to transact the coin at a predetermined future date and price, Tesla invested $1.5 billion in Bitcoin. PayPal announced last March that it would allow its U.S. customers to use cryptocurrency to pay its millions of online merchants. In September, El Salvador became the first country to make Bitcoin legal tender. This, coupled with the fact that big-name brands like AT&T, Home Depot, Microsoft, Starbucks, and Whole Foods now accept Bitcoin payments, could pave the way for mainstream use of cryptocurrency. But if the bulls are right and the price of a single Bitcoin eventually hits $500,000, it could pump more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than what is released by countries like Brazil or Mexico. Another sector shaken up by digital assets in the art world, as digital artworks have been making headlines for the huge amounts they've been selling for on the market through the use of non-fungible tokens, more commonly known as NFTs, a type of guarantee backed by the Ethereum blockchain. In simpler terms, the works are created or minted through a process called proof of work, which establishes its unique identity, as explained in an article on Hyperallergic. This is arguably an improvement over the traditional art market when it comes to storing the value of the original work, but it's terrible for carbon emissions. According to DigiEconomist, the carbon footprint of a single Ethereum transaction as of December 2021 was 102.38 kilograms of carbon dioxide, which is equivalent to the carbon footprint of 226,910 Visa credit card transactions, or 17,063 hours of watching YouTube. Meanwhile, the website further states the electrical energy footprint of a single Ethereum transaction is about the same amount as the power that an average U.S. household uses in 8.09 days. According to Design magazine, in March of 2021, Austrian architect Chris Precht announced that he was abandoning plans to sell digital artworks backed by NFTs due to the environmental impact of mining the digital tokens. He said he had created three digital artworks and wanted to sell them using blockchain technology. Chris Precht explained, "I wanted to create 300 tokens because I had three art pieces and I wanted to make each one in an edition of 100. I would have used the amount of electricity I usually use in 2 decades. Andrew Hatton, head of information technology at Greenpeace United Kingdom, told the US cable network CNBC, "We're largely powering 21st century technology with 19th century energy sources." He attributes this energy usage to the huge amount of data crunching needed to create and maintain this cyber currency, a process that demands a lot of electricity. According to Hatton, the problem is that only about a fifth of the electricity used in the world's data centers comes from renewable sources. Another crucial aspect of cryptocurrency is that there is only a limited supply available. So, over time, as more Bitcoin is mined, the complex mathematics problems needed for transactions get harder to solve, demanding more energy in turn. The system is designed this way so that each digital token that gets issued contains its own unique cryptographic reference to the blockchain, ensuring its security. The issue of energy usage over time is further exacerbated by incentives attached to mining. In terms of Bitcoin, Each time a miner solves the complex hashing algorithm required to produce a Bitcoin, the POW, he or she receives a small amount of the cryptocurrency itself. As Charles Hoskinson, co-founder of Ethereum, told CNBC, the inherent problem with this is that the more successful Bitcoin gets, the higher the price goes. The higher the price goes, the more competition for Bitcoin, and thus, the more energy is expended to mine it. As the price continues to rise, so will the incentive to mine the cryptocurrency, creating a feedback loop that spells trouble for the climate. According to December 2021 figures from the Cambridge Bitcoin Electricity Consumption Index, Bitcoin makes up around 0.52% of the total global electricity consumption. That might not sound like much, but DigiEconomist calculates Bitcoin's total annual power consumption to be around 204.5 terawatt hours, equivalent to the power consumption of Thailand. The Economist noted such numbers should be taken with a good deal of salt. Bitcoin's energy use depends crucially on its price, which swings wildly. The authors of a paper published in April in the journal Nature Communications assumed that the long-term trend will be upward because the rate at which new bitcoins are created is designed to halve every 4 years. Reality will doubtless prove more complicated, but the general picture that Bitcoin is a dirty business fits with other research. One often cited model, which uses publicly available blockchain data, reckons its global energy consumption is already equal to that of Kazakhstan, and that its carbon footprint matches Hong Kong's. Another problem, besides the gargantuan energy usage, is where that energy comes from. There is no definitive statistics related to the proportion of renewable versus fossil fuel-powered electricity used for Bitcoin mining.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from latter's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The US's wrong calculations in their system of calculations keep continuing. The same is true at the present time. Today, too, they make certain calculations about various matters. An example is the events following the martyrdom of our dear Shahid Soleimani. Look at what they thought, but what happened. They thought that by the assassination of Shahid Soleimani, the great movement of resistance that he represented and was a symbol of would be extinguished. But as you have witnessed, this movement has become even stronger. Who launched that great movement this year on the second anniversary of the martyrdom of Martyr Soleimani? In whose hands was it? Who can claim that they were the ones behind the movement? That movement was not possible except with divine power and God's hands. The enemy was not and will not be able to calculate and measure such great movements and the public's admiration of Martyr Soleimani, both inside Iran and outside Iran. The system of calculations of the enemy is really, truly negligent and dysfunctional, and they are unable to fathom the realities related to the Islamic Republic the way they truly are.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When their calculations about the existing situation are wrong, their decision will be wrong as well. And their wrong decisions lead to the failure of the enemies. Until now, they have failed. And now, and from now on too, they will continue to fail, inshallah. Well, my dears, those days are past, but January 9th will not be forgotten. Thankfully, it has survived until today. And from now on too, it will not be forgotten. After the January 9th of tragedy in Qom, the movement reached its peak. God bless the movement launched by the people of Qom, and consequently, the movement reached its peak, leading to the big days of the revolution. Our great Imam returned to the country victoriously. The revolution was victorious, and the Islamic Republic, a religious democracy, was established and came into being. 43 years have passed since that day. These 43 years have been accompanied by struggle on the path of God, numerous ups and downs, and various events. These events form our history, and we must learn from them. But a nation that is alive does not look only at the past.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Shias in Italy, the path of minor Islam in diaspora, is the title of a recent book which illustrates the role, practices and ethnic composition of the Shia communities of Italy. The author is the Iranian expat and Palermo-based Minu Mishahwalad, an established academic researcher with a vast portfolio of publications on Islamic law and Iran's history. Mir Shah Balad's work was carried out in the span of 3 years in 13 different Italian cities, mostly in the north of Italy, where the bulk of the Shia communities reside.
A large number of Shias have moved to Italy's wealthy north for work-related reasons. According to rough estimations, they make up about 5 to 10% of the 2.5 million Muslims residing in Italy. The majority of them are from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. And then we have the Italians who have converted to Shia Islam.
Immigrants from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent are very active in social events and religious rituals, such as the large Ashura ceremony in front of the Milan Central Station. However, also political activism is widespread, particularly among Shias living in Rome, with events organized in solidarity with the assassinated top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
To our Shias, generally organize more events and commemorations compared to Sunni Muslims residing in Italy. Another important aspect of my research shows how among the Shia faithfuls are today also a growing number of Italians. They have found in the Shia Islam a spiritual and political place where they can stand against the U.S. and Israeli's hegemony, where their traditional family values and love for artistic expression are welcomed.
About 2.5 million Muslims are living in Italy, making Islam the country's second largest religion. However, unlike Christianity and Judaism, Islam isn't formally recognized, meaning that mosques cannot receive public financing support, Islamic marriages have no legal force, and Muslim workers aren't entitled to take days off for religious festivities. Mirshak Balad's research book also examines how Shia religious leaders in Italy interact with Shia religious authorities in a diasporic context. Max Civili, Rome.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or UN mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S. Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust Number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonised by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those? I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
North Korea has confirmed its latest missile launches amid growing tensions with the United States over the country's nuclear weapons program. State media KCNA said one of the tests was an upgraded long-range cruise missile and the other a warhead of tactical guided missile. On Wednesday, the South Korean military said it detected the launch of two short-range ballistic missiles. Launches drew condemnation from the U.S. North Korea has recently said it will bolster its defenses against the U.S. and consider resuming all temporarily suspended activities.
Yemenis have marked the 40th day since Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government, Hassan Irlou, passed away. A mourning ceremony was held in the Iranian embassy in Yemen's capital Sana'a on the occasion.
Once again, we express our condolences to the Iranian people, our brothers, on the death of Mr. Hassan Irlou, who contributed a lot to the strengthening of the ties between Yemen and Iran.
In October 2020, Irlou was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, he focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked toward garnering international support for a mechanism that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition.
Everyone knows the stance of the Iranian people and the Iranian government and that they stand with the Yemeni people against the Saudi-led war. Hassan Irlou was a great person. Despite the short period of Irlou's work in Yemen, he performed his duties to the fullest and contributed to the diplomatic process. When I met him in Iran, he used to tell me that he wished to visit Yemen, and thank God his wish came true, even if it was for a short time.
Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 in mid-December, days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a, Khatibzadeh did not name any country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies have been keeping Yemen under blockade since 2015. Despite his short tenure as Iran's ambassador to Yemen, people he say the Iranian diplomat played a pivotal role in strengthening the brotherly ties between Tehran and Sana'a. They hold the Saudi-led coalition responsible for his death caused by the deliberate delay of his return home. Abdulatif Al-Washali from the Iranian embassy in Sana'a.
Stop the Saudi war on Yemen. This is what protesters demand as they gathered outside the United Nations office in Tehran. The rally came in reaction to last week's deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition that targeted a detention facility.